Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of FarmCon Conversations podcast. I'm co-host Todd Lefter with my good friend Kevin Van Trump in Kansas City. Kevin, how are we doing today, sir?
Doing good, buddy. How are you?
Man, awesome. We've made it through hopefully three quarters of a major heat stretch and no rain, so dryland corn out here is going to suffer. Don't think it's going to be much of anything, if anything, but you know what? That's life on the high desert, so it is what it is. Other than that, garden looks great.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Action. What do you got? You guys, you tell me you guys are going to be cooling off here. You guys catching a break that I'm not catching?
Yeah. It's cooling off. It looks like forecast is cooling down a little bit, at least for us here in Kansas City area.
Well,
just outside there, it's going to rain. But, you know, it is what it is.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll get into more of that, I'm sure, in the corn, bean, wheat stuff. So, hey, man, we are in FarmCon Swing, so I just want to share with the listeners that we've got some incredible new talents on the books. You can go to FarmCon.com and see everybody there. But we've added Dan Hartsock, Vice President of Precision Ag Upgrades and AI Data, Senator John Deere, Shane Thomas, the agribusiness analyst who founded Upstream Ag, Greg Peterson, a.k.a. Machinery Pete. Everybody knows Machinery Pete. He's going to come in town. And Dan Maycock. Dan Maycock is the co-founder and CTO of Data Play, and he's a former member of the FCC Precision Ag Connectivity Force. Long story short, I've talked to Dan a bunch. Dan will be on our podcast next week and be interviewed, but he's bringing what I deem, and I hope you do deem after you talk to him, real value and data solutions to turn on-farm, you know, satellite data and stuff into better decisions. So it's going to be pretty exciting.
That's more on the AI front, right, Todd?
Yes, sir. This is full board. This is the guy. I'm accused of being in the weeds. I found the guy that's adding value. He's not the guy that's going to be the OpenAI CEO this and that, but he is down there making things happen for farmers because of what he's done. He's got a great background. I mean, he knows Carter. They've done some similar things. I mean, I think equally one of those, you know, very heavy gray matter type deal, but he is talking long enough to know that his heart's for farmers, and what he's doing is trying to help people replicate what he can do. So it'll be a good conversation.
And Todd and I reached out to Machinery Pete last week. I've been buying a lot more collector tractors, and I think there's a lot of just questions and uncertain about what's going to happen in some of this used equipment market, and not just from a collector tractor standpoint, but just from the what's happening out there in the equipment world in general. So I thought, you know, it'd be nice to have him there just to answer some questions and field some questions. So he's been putting a little more money to work in that collectible space. I will tell you one thing, Todd. We were Jordan drugged me out to a big gun show this weekend, and I'm telling you, packed. I mean, packed. Line out the building again, nowhere to park, parking over in the fields, up on the curbs. I mean, probably the most crowd I've ever seen it. And typically I feel like, we went to gun shows our whole life, but it always felt like when a Democrat was in office, there'd be a lot more people at the gun shows because people were worried about their guns getting outlawed. But boy, I tell you what, it was just crazy crowded, and people were throwing a lot of money around too, it looked like. So kind of interesting.
I wonder if we can use that as a data point, like the Walmart parking lot satellite photos and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I'm telling you, crazy busy.
No, that's they're interesting.
You know, dealers from all over the country, and you know, everybody said they were doing good.
Well, if say you didn't share this with me as you were out there and stuff, what did you get anything?
Jordan picked up. He'd been looking for a Midas grade shotgun Browning, so he picked up an older Browning Midas grade, and then he got a Browning 20 gauge engraved by Angelo B. That's kind of a hot ticket, wow. I guess. These days, and then he got a couple of pigeon grade shotguns, some trap shooting guns that he's gonna. I think he's got somebody that's wanting them or something. So, yeah, he picked up he picked up four or five shotguns, and didn't really see much on the other side of the stick. I ended up with some old antique. It was a Civil War knife, and it was kind of cool, but nothing. You know, we didn't get anything crazy. The Midas grade and the Angela B were nuts. They were some great pieces. But yeah, he had his eye on them for a while. So finally pulled the trigger.
So just as a weekly update, we continue to see what I'm just going to call the alternative markets. We know because you put in the report with the cards and the different things, and then the guns and Western stuff. These just continually stay strong. It sounds like right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got to believe that at some point in time that some of that card market blows up. My gosh, I mean, just crazy numbers keep being thrown around in that the sports cards, the Pokemon cards, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
Jazz. It's just crazy to me with the appreciation. And like I tell everybody, when I tell Jordan when they were trading those meme stocks, and everything, I mean, trees don't grow to the sky. I mean, at some point, you know, you got to – enough's enough. And I would suspect, you know, if I was in the Pokemon space, I'd – like I said, I'd be selling all the one-offs and the ancillary things, you know, just focusing in on a couple of the big names like the Charizard or something. But, you know, just – because I would be hesitant to think that you can continue that widespread with the appreciation. And what will typically happen is when the market will fall, I mean, everyone – it's just like trading anything, guys. And I said last week or the week before, or maybe a few weeks before the market broke kind of heavy in the stock market, I was cleaning up some messes and trimming the weeds. You know, I think too often, and we all probably heard that now, I've been in the trading world, you know, most of the rookies or the amateurs will go out and pick their flowers and let the weeds grow. And better yet, they'll add to the weeds, and weeds are the losers. So, you know, you want to pick the weeds, get them out of there, you throw the losers out, and keep your flowers and let the big profit ones run. But when markets start to drop or falter a little bit, let's say, there used to be a big analogy as traders. We'd always say, you know, the helicopter's starting to list here a little bit. We might be going down. And so you start to throw all the shit off that you don't need and the things that you just don't necessarily need the most, right? So you're not throwing off a bottle of water or you know, water or bandages or first aid kit. You're throwing all the other shit off the plane or the chopper. So same type of thing, say, if you think about it in the Pokemon card space or the baseball card or football card, if the market starts to get weak and waver, everyone will start throwing the middle grade, not mid-grade, but mid-level, mid-tier, just things that they were grabbing and chasing on the way up. They'll throw all that out. I mean, that'll all get dumped. And your stability will be left in just a few concentrated items. So that's what I'm saying, you know. If you're feeling nervous about the stock market, you know, you want to shed all the I'm not sure about this, not sure about that type names, and then you're just sticking to your big names. You know, you have a handful of just that you're like, I'm okay adding into whatever it may be, Amazon, Walmart, Apple, you know, your big names. And then those would be the last to probably tumble. And that's why I'm saying you got to be careful in that collector market. I think too many people become too much of a collector rather than a investor. Does that make sense, Todd? Like, they just get too wide with too many shit, too many different positions, too many different items, you know, and it's just, you get too much out there, just too wide. And then, you know, you got to shake some of that loose. Like I said, the best analogy for me is always, I have to remind myself constantly, let the flowers keep growing, trim the weeds, get rid of the weeds. And I just keep reminding myself, you know, that's how you got to think about it a little bit.
Well, as I'm sitting there listening to you say that, I'm thinking to myself, man, it sounds like you got to have a trader mind. You're like, I should come into this card thing with a, hey, I want 30 cent profit now. I mean, when do you, I mean, I know
that's exactly what I do. No, that's what I do. I mean, I trade collectibles just like I trade.
Okay, you're trading, not investing.
Well, I call it investing. I mean, it just depends. Like I said a million times, I have investing accounts. I have trading accounts.
Yeah.
Let's say John Deere 4020, that's just top of the line. I got a Jubilee that's top of the line. Let's say I'm talking like, you know, what do they call it? Concourse. I mean, they are nice. And I have a 6030 that's coming in that I'm not, those are long-term investments. I mean, there's investments. I'm not looking to trade them, flip them, move them, things like that. Now, there's other things that if I'm at some auctions or let's say I'm watching some auctions and there's some Spurs I like or something, and I think, well, I may have a buyer for that or that looks like a too cheap of a price. Well, then I may buy those as a trade, you know what I'm saying, to buy it and sell it nearby. So, yeah, I mean, there are items, though, that we have that – I mean, are probably not, I'm probably not getting rid of in my lifetime. Now maybe my kids will liquidate and sell, but those are longer term investments in the collectible space. But then, like I said, yeah. And then we have those that are shorter term. So just like in the trading account, just like with real estate and our properties, some properties we buy, some buildings we buy to hold short term, maybe 5 years or less. And then some we're buying to keep and give to the grandkids, hopefully, and their kids. Right. So long term. So, yeah.
Perfect. One last thing I want to say about FarmCon is the partnership that we've basically started this year with the Agriculture Future of America. Basically, it's a nonprofit, and they provide leadership training and scholarships for networking for college
AFA.
Students.
You're AFA. Talking AFA.
Agriculture. Yeah, I said Agriculture Future of America. I just didn't do the acronym. AFA. And we're going to bring a group of kids there. We're going to get sponsors for them, have them there and see the room. I guess, Kevin, you know, they're going to get exposed to things that they, you know, aren't necessarily exposed to in just simple leadership training classroom. So when you look, I'm just going to, made me think of this. When you look back in your career, what do you wish someone would have, you know, shown you earlier about markets, risk, money, business, and how the real operators make decisions that hopefully these kids
Yeah, hell, it wouldn't have mattered when I, early in my career, I was too nuts to have listened to anyone. So,
yeah,
I had plenty of people try to help me, you know, when I was young, I just wasn't at a point, obvious, I wasn't ready to listen probably was the main thing. I thought I knew everything. I look back on that a million times. Todd. I mean, I was lucky and had a lot of great people come in. And I was lucky to have the grandfather I had and just the things where he taught me just, you know, that you could try to steal something from everybody. Even if you didn't like the person, try to steal something, not meaning steal something as in steal, but steal. They were good at something, you know, there was something they were good at. So try to find the good in the people rather than look and want to make negative comments about people or, oh, look at that guy, he done this wrong, or that guy did that wrong. And, you know, that right there is one of the biggest tips I probably got in my life. And that carried forward with everything, whether it was from playing baseball, golf, basketball, football. You know, there were some real knuckleheads I didn't like, but I would always remember that thought. My grandpa would just harp on me like crazy. Like, what'd you see in that guy today that you wanted to steal? Whether, you know, whether I was playing a round of golf, a match against a person, or lined up against the guy in football, or, you know, I, whatever it may be, I was guarding the guy in basketball, and we just had a hell of a battle going, you know. But every time I come off court or off field, my grandpa always be like, what'd you learn from that guy? What'd you learn from that person? And it just changed my mindset probably a lot in life because I then, every person I met, I was trying to think about what I could learn from or what I liked or what they were doing that I could take and make my own. So it's just a whole different mindset. And that's what I tried to do with my own kids. And, you know, like I said, rather than, oh, you got a teacher, you got assigned a teacher that nobody likes, and all the kids, the other parents are taking their kids out of that class. I told my kids, this is your opportunity, this is your challenge. I mean, you're going to find the good things in this person. And you know, everybody's got two or three, and you'll find them. And that's why I said, it didn't matter what coach I had, what person I had, I always tried to find those things, and I always just tried to get a little bit better. So that's probably the best advice I ever got. But when I was young, like I said, I definitely thought I knew everything. And so I'm the one that I'm excited about this AFA thing. I wanted to figure out a way to do more for the kids. And if you recall, Todd, we changed the date of FarmCon. It used to be the Van Trump Prom, whatever the hell my buddies called it and all that. And it was more like in November, December. Well, we changed it to the first week in January because I had a lot of people ask me to move it to there so they could bring their college age kids and their high school age kids. Cause you know, most of the folks could teach their kids how to farm, but they didn't necessarily have the tools or the business accolades to teach them how to run a business and to market and to do those things and to network and, you know, meet people and all that. So we moved the conference each year to that first week in January. So we could hopefully help get some, you know, kids there that could help and be a benefit to them. And then, you know, we gave my report out, and we still do. If there's anyone out there and your kids are in, you know, college or you're in an accredited ag school, we would give the report to kids for free in those classrooms and to those teachers. There were some colleges that would test on it and everything like that. So I think it's important to get the kids acclimated and get them learning the lingo and the language and just how, you know, how to view different things and open them up to different perspectives on marketing and business. So I love the relationship we're going to try and build with AFA. I'm probably kicking myself that we didn't do it sooner. I had some people come to me and say, hey, we should probably be doing something with you. So we're going to try and sponsor 50 kids is what I had planned. I wanted to help sponsor 50 kids to come to the conference, put them up at the hotels, give them some food. We're going to try and get them a room, a big room down on the main level that's separate where folks can come in and talk to them. I can go in and talk to them, meet them, introduce myself, you know, give them my number if they need anything moving forward, if I can help them in any way. And, you know, just have some other leaders in the ag world, you know, I guess give them some different perspectives on thoughts of where we see things going and where the opportunities might lie and what might be a good place to, you know, I guess push your boat off in that direction for a career and, you know, things like that. So I'm excited. I'm trying to, as I wrote in the story this week, I'm trying to do more to give back, and I like giving back to the kids, and I want to do it in the ag world because it's helped our family so much. So, you know, I think it's something we're going to do every year, and so I'm wanting to build this right, do it right with the show, with AFA, and the reason it wasn't FFA, we love FFA, and we try to donate and do things for FFA as well. We just thought the older kid might benefit a little bit more here at FarmCon because we have so many ag leaders in the room and folks that own ag businesses. This might be a good opportunity to match some kids up with some business owners or give them a shot at some really good kids that have been vetted and all that through AFA. I think AFA is going to open it like to their whole group, and then they're going to have a contest and narrow it down and get to this final 50 that are awarded the thing, then they'll be at the event and the show, and we'll do them all up, and it'll be good. I think it's going to be really good, and I think it's something that we should be proud of longer term, and hopefully I'm going to open up and have some of my friends sponsor some kids and, you know, help get kids through some programs and things like that. So, you know, I think it's going to be a win-win, Todd, for everybody, and we're excited that we can do that for people, so it should be nice.
No, you're right. It's something we, you know, you do it now, it's like, man, we should have done this earlier and stuff, but glad we're starting now. And it's caused me to learn and go dive deep a little bit because I've heard of FFA and stuff. AFA, I really haven't heard that much about outside of the fact they're in Kansas City. But what they do is a whole different drum. It's, you know, the corporate track. And but it is a commitment. And so I'm going to be interested to hear what these kids say after being FarmCon 2 days. I think it's going to be awesome. I think it's going to grow huge, and it's going to be something that everybody is going to win from. So looking forward to that. All right, diving into corn, bean, and wheat, Kevin, let me do the thing. The commentary and market insights shared by Kevin and our guests on this podcast are for educational and informational purpose only and do not constitute specific trading, hedging, or investment advice. Futures and options trading involves significant risk, and listeners should consult with their own professional advisor before making any decisions. All right, let's roll. Kevin, you said it's getting tougher for USDA to defend their 183 corn yield. Definitely agree. And now you're closer. You actually threw out a 178 in yesterday's report, 178 to 180. What has changed enough to make this move?
Well, I just said, you know, like I said, I don't know. I'm bamboozled by the USDA, though, every year, so it doesn't really matter probably where I'm at. I thought last year's 186 was, you know, 186 was nuts. I thought it was high. I still think they could come back and trim the damn thing. I just thought it was high. I thought the acres were high last year. I feel like the acres are a little high this year. I thought starting out at 183 was a little high, you know, so I was there at 181.5. And, you know, I said from the jump when we had all the rain and moisture from my perspective anyway, and at least from my experiences with my pops, you know, farming way back when with my grandfather, the wetter years were always tricky. I mean, the wetter years always looked good from the road, you know, from the truck driving around. But It even looked good right after harvest time. I mean, it really would, you know. And then we'd get, I think we'd be more disappointed on the wetter years, and we'd be kind of down the dumps on the drier years, and then we'd be surprised when we got in the field that it was better than expected. So I don't know. Like I said, these wet years are tricky. At least from my experience, I think they're tricky. And I'm not saying this is going to be for everywhere, because I know there's some guys that are saying they think it could be a little better than they thought. So I'm just telling you, it's going to be a really wild finish. And, you know, the USDA can interpret it however they see to interpret it. And, you know, I just try to remind everyone, it isn't about being right the yield. It's about being right the market. And just meaning you may have the greatest intel in the world. And so we used to have people, I just back up and say, you know, we had people coming to us all the time in Chicago and other places trying to sell us what they believed was the best intel and data, right? You had the one group, I can't remember their name for the life. I can't remember anything anymore, hardly. But I can't, they'd start and harvest down south, and they had, I don't know, 20, 30, 50, I don't remember how many combines they had at one time. They'd work their way to the north and customer, and, you know, they're going to sell all that data off the combines and have a lot more accurate yield data than real-time yield data than we were getting at the time. Then we had the satellite imagery people come, and they were going to give us yield. And then we had these people come that had the heat sensing technology. They were giving us yield data. But, you know, it really doesn't matter, because what if the yield is 175, but the USDA is at 185, and the market's going to trade the 185? I'm just telling you. And so you can be as right as the day is long on the yield, but if you're wrong the market and wrong what the USDA is going with it, I mean, you're just going to get annihilated. So the whole game is to try and figure out what the USDA is going to do, not necessarily what might really be out there. You got to figure out how they're going to play their card. And that's what I'm saying. We got to be careful here, because, you know, I felt like the last few years we've tend to have been more bullish, thinking I've underestimated the crop. I'll just tell you, each of the last two or three years, I just don't think the crop's as big as the numbers that the USDA came out with. But I'm obviously wrong. So that's where I'm telling people I'd be hesitant to maybe follow me down this path, just because I haven't been as accurate as some people like Stonex. Hell, I think Stonex has been kind of on it the last few years. Now, I know they've caught a lot of hell, but Arlen and those folks over there have, you know, everybody's bitching because they were high. They're coming out and raising numbers, and they were high on their. Well, hell, I think they've been probably the closest of anyone. You know, I've been too conservative, I guess, or too lax on it. But I just sit here in my head and I say, I think that number was high last year. And then you go out this year, and I wrote out in the report this week, I mean, North Carolina came in 61% below last year on their condition rating. Colorado's 40% below. South Dakota, 26% below. North Dakota, 22. Texas, 21 below. Nebraska, 17 below. Illinois, Kansas, 12 below each. Missouri's 11 below. Wisconsin, 9 below. And you got Iowa, 7 below last year. So it's like, it's tough for me to sit here and say you're at 183. I mean, you know, so I'm ratcheting her down a little bit. I was at 181.5. I'm probably closer to 180 now. And I mean, you know, if you're a Vegas bookie, you know, or you're an odds maker, I don't know. What do you have the over under at on yield? 181, 180? I don't know. 180, so you're saying?
Actual yield or USDA number yield?
Yeah, I want to know what you think the USDA will end up at.
Well,
what will they end up at in January's report? January report.
Okay, my overrunning where the USDA. Well, I would be in my mind. I can't make that guess until I see the September report, because.
Well, whatever. You're an idiot, then.
I know that. Okay. Well, Kevin.
I can't make that call until I see it. Well, no shit.
All right, well, let me say this. I'm stuck on – I wanted to back up. Okay, to answer your question, it's going to be over. It will be over.
No, I just said, what's the over-under line? What would you make?
180 and a half is the over-under line. But okay. Then let me ask you.
That's a tough one. So, I don't,
In your, you've been doing this a long time, and you can see you've seen the entrenchment in certain things. When you sit there and tell me, and you've said this for 10 years, but do you ever see a day where we'll start using private numbers due to the technology advantages they have to do it, or even if we had those things, and maybe it's happening now, as long as USDA is putting out a number, that's where everyone's going to stick and have to deal with how the market moves. Is that ever going to change, I guess, what I'm asking, based on
I can never say never say never, but I think the USDA is using more intel to get to their number. And, you know, I think, like I said, I certainly wouldn't want the job, and I think they do a hell of a job doing what they do just to get to where they get. Now, everybody's going to sit back and armchair quarterback the damn thing. But, no, I think that, you know, as long as the USDA is in business, as long as the USDA gets funded and has enough personnel to somewhat get the number fairly close, I think that's what the world's going to trade off of now.
Right.
You know.
So,
and I think the USDA would adopt any technology, and I think they would use any technology that they felt was absolutely solid enough to give them more accurate data. And I think there's going to be some adjustments had to be made with these farm surveys and things like that, because they're just not getting the feedback they had in the past. And I think some of the feedback they're getting is a little iffy at best. So, I suspect that they're making adjustments to all that, but I don't know that firsthand. And I have USDA tell me before from their top brass when we've been talking that, you know, people put way too much weight in these weekly crop condition estimates. And
right.
There were some from within the USDA that when I was talking to folks there, you know, they wish that there were some folks there, I should say, not ever, but some folks there that wish that would go away, because it kind of then handcuffs the USDA. Like I'm saying, these crop conditions are lower. You'll see massive. There's no way you can see the swings that get reported. Like, look at the swings in North Dakota, Colorado,
right.
North Carolina, on a weekly basis. I try to tell everyone what used to happen. I don't know if it's changed. I mean, it was basically just a couple guys in a truck going around doing mostly, you know, window assessments out
yeah.
of the truck on the
yeah.
drive-by. It isn't like there's in-field testing or anything. I mean, it's just kind of an arbitrary number, and I think the trade really hangs a lot of weight on it. And then then they want to look at that and then put heat on the USDA on their yield adjustment number, when I don't think the USDA puts a ton of weight on those weekly condition numbers for making their assessment. So that's where I'm saying I think everybody gets themselves a little too tripped up in that. Just like Kevin Wash is coming out and saying he wants the Fed to report.
Exactly.
And I think he's probably right on that. I hate to say it, but I think he's probably right on that, because it's just, you know, just too much info, too much, and it's too early. I mean, hell, we don't know what the yield's going to be at this point. I mean, you can have an idea on the corn a little bit now, but like beans, tell some of my best producers and some of my best buddies that, you know, raise crazy amounts of beans, hell, they don't know their yield. I mean, they'll be 2 weeks from harvest, and we're still trying to guess the damn yield. We're still not dead on. You know what I'm saying? Just things can change so much, and in those last few weeks, and I don't know, but I do know this. I think the market kind of has that priced in a little bit. I mean, it'd be my guess.
So then, with the pro farmer crop tour taking place on the 17th, the WASDE's on the 12th. I mean, all this stuff, then, basically, in your mind, it really don't matter. I mean, we're not going to see a major correction on the August report anyway, even if they adjust a little. I mean, I could be easy to say, if we're right, and they're going down to where you were saying, obviously they'll probably come down to 181.5 or something in August and then make their final move in September and October. But basically,
well, typically they're not going to – well, the last thing they want to do is over-adjust and then have to readjust mm-hmm. back, which I've seen happen.
Right.
You know, but – think they're going to come out and cut 5 bushels off the average and then have to go back and raise 3. I mean, I don't see that. You know, I think they would maybe cut like 1 or 2
right.
bushels if and then maybe again look at it again in September when they get more field data, and then, you know, they'll get some farm surveys I believe, here in August. And, you know, they may move it ahead, may move something, you know. And then maybe it gets into September's report and October, where you get after the next quarterly stocks. You know, maybe they readjust. Like I said, there's a lot of folks sitting out there thinking they got that feed and residual number still too high, and it needs to be backed off substantially, 100, 200 million bushels. Ethanol could be trimmed a little well. But there's some chatter and talk that I think there's some people talking like I'm talking that I think they could come out and reduce last year's crop so it could offset some of those setbacks. There's even some folks that say they might not even adjust the demand side. They come out and cut next year's crop, last year's crop, and then they lower the yield for this year's crop. I mean, there's some folks out there talking you could get, you know, you could get down closer to a 1.2, 1.4 billion bushel carry. I'm not in that camp. I'm not. I think they still got to, like I said, I think they got to lower that feed and residual number. I think they could offset it if they cut and reduce last year's crop size and then come out here and lower this yield down. So I'm holding some bullish positions right now, Todd. I own some calls. Like I said, I don't know. Maybe it's just a little bit of a gamble. I think with all this war and all these crazy war headlines going on, you know, I think there could be some things out of position, whether it be fertilizer, the inputs, logistics like we're seeing happen in Russia. But you know, I think the break. I'm saying this thing trades between 420 and 520. 470 would be the midpoint of that range. That's about where we're trading at. I think, you know, if you're an end user, I'd be looking to be a buyer, locking in. If we can get down in that 440-ish range to 420-ish. If I'm selling, I'm looking to price sell. Just want to rally back from 490 to 520. And so as a spec, I like playing the bullish side of it. So, like I said, I have a small position right now. Further break, I'm going to try and add to it, buy some more calls, and then see where we end up here, how the USDA adjusts as we move forward. So that's kind of how I'm playing, buddy.
Well, and you just, as you always do, I love it, you get into some future questions. So you just told us what you're doing. You had the bullish calls, the break, but you're still trading small. So what – give us the insight on, you know, hey, I want to be in the market, but not be in over aggressively yet.
Well, you know, from a trading perspective, my rule of thumb's pretty – typically it's this. You know, if we're trading above the major moving averages and the overall trend itself is to the upside, I will only be bullish. And vice versa, typically, I will only be bearish if we're below and we're trading in a longer-term downward channel. I would only be bearish. Just simply because I don't want to try to navigate the flip-flop of that. And object in motion tends to stay in motion, trend's your friend. We could go with every analogy you want to go with. That's typically how I'll play it. And, you know, if I'm into a market that I believe is going to be demand-driven, I put on small positions, very small positions, and I look to buy the breaks because I always, you know, I believe demand markets always give you multiple opportunities to get back in, so I like to buy the breaks, add to those positions, and I'll even add some on breakouts to the upside in demand markets. It just varies on that. But, no, that's how I like to play it, Todd. I you know, like I said, it just depends the type of trade, the position. If I'm looking, you know, if you're bottom picking, you know, maybe you don't play it that way. You know, if you're bottom picking, maybe you buy a bigger position and you're just trying to just clip a little bit out of it, you know, and to make it that way. It's just like we talked about in beans. You asked me this week. I had bought some puts last week on the big rally up because I thought, man, that was a pretty impressive run higher. And they really, you know, they really took some of the juice out of those puts. So I bought the puts. We flip-flopped around, broke heavy on Monday. I got out of the puts, took my profits, moved to the sideline, and actually sat there later and said, hell, I think I want to be bullish here on this. I think they took too much out of it. And so I flipped, and I bought a bunch of calls. Not a bunch. I bought some calls. And, you know, I'm going to sit here in these calls, and if they break lower, I'll probably be adding to it. I think there is going to be a demand story longer term. So, you know, and
I've listened to you 1,000 times, as you know, and you Always tell me, I told you this, I told you. But what you just said there, as you explained that answer, and you used the phrase, hold on, where did I put it here? You used the phrase, I don't want to manage a flip-flop. I've never heard you say that, and yet it just instantly made me clear as a bell what you're doing. And that was cool. So I hope everybody else had a little aha moment like I just did. Stay in the trend line. It's above moving average. It just it seems it was so obvious, but it, just, it hit me. Anyway, that was that. All right, we're going to move on to soybeans. They slipped again, or conditions slipped again, and they're still staying with 53. Got guys penciling 50 to 52, so it kind of sounds similar to corn. I mean, my question is, it gets going to make you, we're just going to pass on it because it's the same thing as corn. I mean, what kind of gap appears and how does it show up in the price action? I mean, is it, how do, if you're a grower, and so you're going to say stick. Can how does the market react to these gaps? Does it react to the gaps, or are you sitting there saying, don't play, don't worry about the gaps, stick
with? Are you talking about gaps in the chart?
I'm sorry. No, I apologize. Gap in the, when the private industry has the pencil in 50 to 52 bushels, USDA is 53. When you get this, when you get a gap in what the yield projections are, I mean, like I said, we address it a little bit in corn, but. How's the market?
Yeah, you're just mainly talking the divergence between the public and the private. You know, like the USDA is at 53 bushels an acre, and there's private folks out there at 50, 51, somewhere, you know, 52. Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, I think the market's probably trading that to some degree. Correct? I mean,
yeah.
Meaning they're trading that the USDA is probably going to cut that yield a little bit. That's why we're trading. You know, we were pushing closer to $13 up there. We got up there at 12.55. Back to that 1260 range, and 1260 has been a troublesome number. I told everybody in the report, I wrote many, several times over the past, I don't know, 2 months, I said, if you feel you're behind in sales, you know, you really got to be paying attention. You get up here in this 1240, 1260 range, and you're having trouble, really trouble between 1250 and 1260. Well, sure as hell, what did we trade? 1255, and we couldn't get through 1260, and so, so I'm saying you got to be looking to feather in some sales up there if you feel you're behind. We're sitting at about 50% price, so I'm not really looking to get a lot more price. I would like to get another 10% price between now and harvest, but I think there's going to be an opportunity similar to what you said with the corn, Todd, or what we talked about. If you held a gun to my head, I'm going to say this bean market is going to trade, and this is, as I wrote, it doesn't take any – I mean, it isn't rocket science to toss out some of the numbers I'm using. This is, I mean, when someone asks you where they think corn's going to trade and you give them a dollar range, I mean, it ain't like you're really putting yourself out there. That's why I'm saying 420 to 5. Hell, I ain't, any idiot could tell you that. I mean, no shit. And I'm sitting here in the no beans and I'm saying we're probably going to trade 1120 to 1320. And I've got to use these wide ranges. I remember trading corn to hold. Hell, the whole year it didn't move 20 cents in the whole entire year. But now when you got multiple wars going on, you've got a lot of uncertainty about inputs. You got uncertainty about trade with China. You got uncertainty on every front. I mean, you're going to have wider range. And so I sit in my head and I say, as I see things today, it wouldn't surprise me to see corn at 1320. It wouldn't surprise, or excuse me, beans at 1320. It wouldn't surprise me to see beans at 1120. Either I could wake up tomorrow and I could be at either price, and I'd be like, interesting. I mean, I wouldn't really just flip out about it. And so that's where I'm sitting in my head, and I think we're going to trade probably somewhere in that area for the next bit. And so, you know, 1220 is the midpoint of that range. That's where we were pretty much. It's where we're trading at. And, you know, I got a bullish position on that. And I'm looking to add on the breaks. And as a producer, I'm looking to price more bushels for us, for me. I'd say in that 1280 to 1320 range is where I'll be looking to make the next sale. Now, if we get back up closer, you know, in that 1250 area, and there's talk that there's a peace deal and crude oil's under pressure somehow and this, that, and the other, well, I probably might make some sale right there. So it just depends on what headlines are happening at the moment. But that's kind of where I see the range. And you know, I think I'm setting up. I'm trying to get in position to set up because I think the domestic crush is really going to fire on all cylinders.
Like when? Said, when?
Sepak Nov. I think Sepak Nov. I think when harvest hits and the bushel's there, I think these crush facilities are, you know, done their maintenance. They're in position. I think they're ready to roar. And I think you're going to see some. I think you're going to see some surprisingly good. Not that we haven't already. I think we've seen some great U.S. demand numbers already. But I think they're going to even get better, maybe surprise some folks to the upside. If, by chance, at the same time, we were to get a little bit more of a surprise from China, holy shit, now I think we got a real story. And what just so happens to be happening around that same time I just said to you, supposedly
meeting.
Supposedly, President Xi is going to come in from China at September, end of September, I think September 24th, 28th, somewhere in there. But maybe they offer out a courtesy big buy from China on some beans. I don't know. But anyway, I'm just saying that's how I'm kind of playing it. I don't want to go in there gangbuster like crazy and be all triple bulled up and taking a huge position just because there's a lot of things that could happen between now and then that could really rock you and knock you out of that position. So you got to kind of, you know, that's why I say I trade in small here because with the volatility where it is, just so you don't get knocked out. And meaning knocked out just simply is, okay, a peace deal happens in the Middle East, crude oil prices drop back $60 a barrel. Well, they're going to take 50 cents to 80 cents off this bean market in a hurry and maybe even more. And that's just how it's going to play because a lot of the people that jumped in it were jumping in it for, you know, an energy play and an inflationary play. Okay, that unwinds. Well, it's going to unwind, and here we're going to be back down to the lower end of that range. That's why I said be careful. Now, if that don't happen, if that does not happen, which may not, we may stay in a conflict for an extended period. I don't think that's going to be the case, though. I'm worried that – I'm thinking if we'll get into that, though. We're going to get into that. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will, because I don't know that I agree with that. But, yeah, we'll get into that. But let me ask this. You're in – everything you just said about your position, you're an option, right? You're not in futures. You're in options on this trade.
I was talking to Andy. I was telling him that a while back, too, and some other trader. But, you know, I've seen some great opportunities. And there's more and more people trading options. And the volatility gets absolutely nuts anymore. And just meaning this, I've said to you, and, you know, I've tried, you wanted to learn how to trade and invest and those things. And I said, it's like a top-level college wrestler is what you need to be. You know, that kind of has to be your mindset. And I remember when Jordan was wrestling, he was down at Tulsa National. He was all these big-time wrestling tournaments. Jordan was a good wrestler. Wasn't the best, you know, wasn't the best in the world, but he definitely won tons of tournaments and won lots of things. But I'm telling you, the kids, when they got to that high level, patience, and they waited for their opponent to make a mistake. And when the opponent made a mistake, God, they capitalized. I mean, they got on it, you know, and the best, you know, you watch those matches, they'll be 2-1, 1-3, you know, they're, and it's just one mistake and that's it. And they take it and boom. So I think in the options markets, there's a lot more mistakes made. There's a lot more options to get way out of whack and get goofy in the overnights and in the thin trades. And there's people coming in. I know there's knuckleheads coming in there running 100 lot orders or 50 lot orders, throwing them at the markets, and the option price gets way skewed out. So I'll put resting orders in there in these option markets. And when you'll have some big moves, you'll be surprised at what kind of bargains you can pick up or where, you know, I think the market just gets a little out of whack. And that's where I just try to use my patience and try to take advantage of that. So that's all that happened, you know, with some of those soybean markets. So when the market gets real volatile like this, I like to do that and put price resting orders in there and just see if I can get the market or one of those option strikes to make a mistake and get out of whack in relation to the other strikes, and then that's kind of where I gain an edge a little bit.
Well, that's where we just need to learn what making a mistake looks like. As a rookie like me, I'm still learning that, but the plan makes sense, and I like it.
That's all. And by using options, I feel at least I can limit my risk to some degree, but
right.
I don't know anymore. You know, they can, it's just like trading spreads. Hell, you used to trade spreads to limit your risk to some degree. Hell, now I think in some of these spreads, it's more risky to be in the spread than it is the outright futures, just because the spreads can get so out of whack again. So just interesting how things change through the years with the different the algos and the high frequency and how they can make things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Get a little
speed,
so, yeah.
Hey, speed and leverage, quite a weapon, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, last question I have for you in soybeans. I think you brought it up. You may have brought it up. But is the all-important August weather window for soybeans changing with earlier planted acres now? I mean, is it moving up a week or two or a couple of weeks? And,
well, that's what I would just think. You know, we all sit and say it's August. But, you know, it was August back, you know, 30 years ago when I first started, 40 years ago, whatever it may have been. You know, but since then, oh, my gosh. I mean, beans are getting planted earlier and earlier and earlier. And quite a bit more beans are being planted earlier and earlier. And so I don't know. I'm with you. Yeah, maybe that is the case. Maybe you're having – maybe it's a bump up. Instead of it being August, all about August, maybe it's about the last 2 weeks in July and then the first 2 weeks in August. So I don't know. I think it's close either way. But, you know, I guess the weather's going to be important.
Well, it always is. So moving on to wheat, I mean, we touched on this last week, and, I mean, we're watching the global logistics just, I guess you could call it deteriorator, choke points, and we'll talk more about choke points in the down the road. But what do you got to say about wheat and it getting moved out? I mean, obviously we know what the supply issue is, but what about the actual getting it where it needs to go? Is this going to – how much room is there to upside if this thing goes crazy?
Well, I'm bullish wheat right now. I mean, I'm long corn, I'm long beans, and I'm now long wheat. I have been on the sideline there for a while, and I may be a little bit. I'm long some soft red winter. I'm long a little bit of hard. You know, I think soft red. You could pull it back into that 620, 6.6 range. So somewhere in there, you know, I think there's some opportunities to maybe be a buyer again. I think logistics are going to stay a problem for longer in that Black Sea region. And for the life of me, I just can't see that conflict ending without some type of crescendo of, you know, skyrockets in flight. I just I think there's just going to be some finale of firing that could really tear some shit up and even more so than it already is. So, I like, again, similar story to what I said. I think supply is just going to be massively out of position. I shouldn't say there's going to be any supply side issue because I don't really think there will be. The U.S. is obviously tight with the, you know, crop that we haven't seen this size in 50 years that bad, and I think spring wheat conditions could come down a little bit. But I don't really necessarily feel we're going to have a supply side story. I think it's going to be, it's just out of position and there could be some demand complications and some demand problems. So that has me a little concerned and, you know, I think be a buyer on the breaks. As a producer, I don't have much at all left to price. We wanted to go ahead and de-risk on those earlier rallies, which was great. We have 30% of 2027's production already priced at, I think, what, numbers north of 725. So I'm not in any race to price anymore as a producer. I think stay patient. See how some of this plays out.
All right. Well, hey, listen, one last question before we're going to get on a nice little topic in regards across the corn, bean, wheats. I mean, they're all bullish arguments on the table. What they're not calling markets right now. So what do you tell producers decide when to use the rallies to reduce risk without feeling like they're giving up on a bigger upside story? I mean, there's a lot of guys that always think, oh, it's going up. But you touched on this last week, but just give a parting comment to guys that, you know, they need to reduce risk.
I don't even understand that mentality, but sure. I mean, that's just FOMO. That's how you trade. I don't, you know, I can't get behind that.
Not anymore. Not in polling.
Well, no, I'm just saying, I just – I mean, it's a trade. You got to learn how to take losses. You got to learn how to let things go. You can't always be second guessing yourself. That's all psychological stuff.
You know what? That's my lesson. Don't need to bring that one up anymore. So.
But I mean, that's the same as playing golf. I mean, getting over the last shot that you just hit in the shitter. I mean, you just hit the ball over in the weeds, and now you're going to let that bother you, and now you're going to lose the tournament because that's in your head. I mean, okay. I mean,
yeah.
No different. It's the same thing. So.
All right. Well, let's get you fired up on this one. So we made a new friend recently, Ivan Sabal of Salus out of New York, and he provided us some content. We wrote a story on it, and the gist of it was that, ag's still fine, but, capital's not just flying anywhere more it wants to make sure there's cash flow. The bottom line to the whole thing was that producers are, continue to be supported by strong land values and government payments. Now, you and I have thoughts on this, and, I want you just to start out and go. I know that you got some strong thoughts about should we even be looking for.
Well, what were you asking? What's the question? I guess.
It's a softball question to let you go, to let you continue the conversation you and I were having when you were sharing your thoughts on the government pumping money at this thing constantly and the land price. Because you and I both agree, shoot, land prices. I mean, if interest rates go nuts, I mean.
Oh, based off the Celsius research report.
If I was not clear on that, yes. So
sometimes you talk so fast, I don't know if people can understand.
I'm trying to slow down, Kevin.
Yeah, there we go. that Celsius report, we shared it in the report from Celsius. I thought it was good. They had a lot of great data in there. You don't necessarily have to agree with it, but from our standpoint, I like to see it just because we invest quite a bit in ag startups and – as you could see from the data that we put in the report, that whole sector has pretty much gotten decimated as of late. You just haven't, I think the peak was in 2021 that we've seen the peak of money coming in to the space. And, there's a little bit of worry of that on all fronts. I shouldn't say it's just ag. With these big IPOs coming out, all the other alternatives avenues for money these days, whether it be with cryptos or whether it be over here with collectibles or whether it be with land or whatever it may be. I don't know if there's enough money to go all around. So you've seen there has been a major pullback or tapering off of money coming into ag. And Todd and I got into the debate and argument. We didn't really get into an argument. I think we're both on the same agreement that we would have a major farm crisis on our hands if it wasn't for elevated land prices and subsidies from the government, the additional subsidies from the government that we've seen in the last several years. So if it weren't for the elevated land prices, which, I sit here and scares the hell out of me just because I was a part of the carnage in that 08 meltdown in the housing crisis. We were, we were developing, building, like I said, single family, multifamily, hell, I was even building log homes across the country. So we were spread out, and I'm telling you, we just got our legs chopped out. Hell, went bankrupt and had our legs chopped out from under us. And I remember Todd speaking for, Nebraska Bankers, right?
Yep.
When was that? Hell, that had to be 10 years ago, I'll bet. And I bet it was maybe more than that. But it was for all the bankers, kind of the big bank group in Nebraska. And they said, when's these land prices going to stop going higher? I said, well, whenever you guys stop loaning. And they just laughed. And I said, no, don't laugh a lot. I mean, I was part of this. No, wait. And that housing crisis didn't peak until those banks stopped lending, because the banks just kept wanting to give me more money, more money, more money. I was putting out more spec houses, Hell, I think Jay that used to work for me, Wilson, worked with us here. I think Jay had 200-300 spec homes sitting when we cracked, when we broke. Not even that many sitting, but yeah, he got chewed up. But But the banks were just lending. And government program after program coming out to support buyers, how this, that, and the other with housing and blah, blah, blah. So I sit here and I'm like, ag bank after ag bank, lending, and government's giving subsidy after subsidy, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, oh, boy. I'm not forecasting that type of debacle, but it certainly has me nervous. And, you know, I'm worried. I think the subsidies are a problem. And
they are. Nobody wants
like
to talk about it.
Ground. I haven't been able to buy anything in the last couple of years. Just, I'm telling you, I just haven't seen the pullbacks that I thought were needed. Nothing pencils. You know, you're basically buying it as a play for the kids or the grandkids. But I don't know. I feel like we have tons of new buyers in the space, right? Through solar, through data centers, to whatever. But are we at peak buyers? See, 10 years ago, Todd, I felt like we were going to have this wave of buyers come in. And I was out telling people, we're going to have a wave of buyers come in this Landmark. And guess what? We have. And now I sit here and say to myself, are we at peak buyers? Meaning, are we going to start to have fewer and fewer buyers?
I don't think so.
Maybe.
I mean,
you don't think
there's too many.
I'm thinking
there's
maybe.
There's too many of these alternative, these family offices, these funds being put together to purchase them land, the REITs and every. I don't see it for, especially you know, in the near term. If
hello?
I don't. So there may be a little bit of a.
Well, no, near term. Who cares about near term?
Yeah,
I'm not
talking
near term. I'm talking 10 years, 5, 10 years from now.
No, I don't think. No, I don't. I mean, something upset. The buyers are going to be there because there's too many.
Okay.
There's too much big money. Unless
I totally. I mean, that's just ludicrous to even make that statement, in my opinion, because you don't know what you don't know. And to say the buyers are going to be there, I promise you. After this, every home builder in America, and every concrete guy, and every roofing company, they all said the buyers are going to be there in 2005 and 6 too. And then in 2008, there wasn't a buyer to be found. So when that's the problem. That's what I'm trying to say. There's no risk here that's being looked at real-time market to market. All the banks are assessing and issuing loans based on the current valuation of farm ground. Now, I'm not nuts here. I've lived through plenty of markets. You can have plenty of giant pullbacks, and I'm talking massive pullbacks. And that's what I'm saying. You can't sit here and say, oh, there's always going to be buyers here. I question that. I remember my pops lived through the farming crisis, and I was little. I was a kid at that time. But there weren't buyers then. There weren't many buyers of farm ground at that point. And so you're sitting here and telling me, oh, all these funds are going to buy farm ground. Well, they're not going to buy farm ground if they're getting redemption after redemption and people are calling back their money back home. That's what I'm trying to say. Every damn thing is elevated right now, so nobody's calling their money back home. But let this shit break and get under pressure, and let some of these let the Pokemon card market collapse. Let the collector car market collapse. You know, let this housing market get a little more. Let the stock market just get throttled. And then and tell me if you got a lot of buyers out there still of ground, big chunks of ground. I question it.
And well, listen, what
all I'm saying is 10 years ago, when I'm out there talking to Tom, well, I'm talking to other guys, I'm saying, yeah, I think we need to keep buying ground, because I think we're going to keep seeing more and more buyers come into the market. Listen to what I'm saying. The key is just like stock, everything. You got to have more buyers coming in, more and more buyers. Now, all I'm asking is, you're thinking that the buying pool is going to get bigger than it currently is? I'm not sure of that. 10 years ago, yes, I was definitely sure of that. But now, You already have the funds in buying ground. You already have data centers trying to buy ground. You already have solar people trying to buy ground. You already have the farm guy trying to buy ground. You have this person trying to buy ground. You're saying that number of people buying ground is going to increase from here. Now, if so, maybe. But I'm saying be careful on that one. Be careful there. I'm not sure of that. I was sure the last 15, 20 years, 10, 15 years. I'm not no longer sure. Because to me, that buyer pool has expanded dramatically, and that's why we're hanging in there. That's why we're holding in there. That's right. But if that buyer pool starts to regress and starts to shrink and not be and expand as it has, it's no different than ethanol. I mean, shit, we were having great growth in ethanol. You know, we're adding 500 million bushels a year, bop, 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 bop. Well, now here we are. We stabilized that. We're kind of plateaued. Okay, so you're not getting the demand growth that we were getting each year from ethanol. It's pretty stagnant, maybe a touch here and there. So you can't keep adding as many damn acres every year to the pie and think that prices are going to keep going higher because you're getting more and more. You see what I'm saying?
No, you're 100% on. And so you would factor none of the peripherals, like the fact that they make any more land, that it's a hard asset, which is a good thing to own.
That they're not making any more land, but do they need to make any more land? Why do they need to make more land?
Okay,
I've heard that argument my whole life. They're not making any more land. Okay, do we need to make more land?
Well, at this point, no, especially if you go to outer space, no. I mean, no, you're making...
So, yeah, I've listened to all kinds of people tell me we're not going to be able to feed 10 billion people. Now, that's a crock. I don't even think you're going to get to 10 billion people globally, number one.
It does not look that way. It does not.
And number two, you got a glut of food to feed 10. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think you're going to farm less and less acres. I mean, I really do, because I think you're going to produce more and more on the ground that you have. And there's tons of ground that's already sitting idle. There's lots of government-owned ground. So when everyone said they're not making any more ground, do we need to be making any more ground?
Hey, fair question.
I got it. I love farm ground. I own farm ground too. But I'm hesitant to sit and be delusional to some degree and just say, well, it's always just going to keep going up because it just does. I mean, I'm not saying, I mean, sure, with inflation and things of that nature, this, that, and the other. But I'm saying be careful here. We've had one hell of a run in land, but we've added a massive amount of new buyers to that pie, which has caused the run in higher prices for land. I think land will continue to appreciate in and of itself because you can do more with it. Meaning, and this is all I'm going to say to you, if you could produce 100 bushels an acre on that piece of ground 20 years ago, and now you're producing, or 30 years ago, and now you're producing 250 bushels on that ground, well, of course that ground should have doubled, more than tripled, you know, because of the production it is able to kick off, just like the solar. Solar's being a lot more aggressive by our ground because it has gotten a lot better, and so it can now pencil to be put on that ground. But at some point, I think you start to lose as many buyers as you. I think there's a massive land grab going on right now amongst data centers, solar, farm, ag, this, that, and the other. And you know, and that's keeping us up here. It's keeping us afforded, and it's nice. And it's keeping prices even moving higher in places. And that's why I said I don't buy a damn thing.
Okay. And your outlook for you currently is a five-year window before you start seeing that dry up, is what I'm hearing, ish.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be looking to buy ground on some massive bargain. I would not be wanting to buy high and sell higher in this environment right here.
Okay.
I'm typically that guy, right? Buy high, sell higher. And that's what I was saying 10 years ago. I was telling folks that, my friends, my family, buy high, sell higher. Because I felt like you were just going to get more and more buyers coming into the marketplace. No different Pokemon cards, no different baseball cards, whatever it may be. Now I'm sitting and saying, are you going to get more buyers coming into this pool? Who the hell's a new buyer that's coming in that didn't know that they, you know, wasn't interested in buying land 10 years ago or 5 years ago?
So what the heck
the data center player came in a big bad way, but on top of that, I don't know where the next one's going to come from, but you would need a next one. You're going to need a next one. You see what I'm saying?
Got that one. And you just made me think of this again. It's oversimplified, but another trading theory or message theory. Find out what areas where the more buyers are going to come in. I mean, I'm thinking gold right now. Very
no
few people.
Kidding. No kidding, dummy. That's
but
what I preach the whole lot. Okay, what? Hey, just like in the collectibles, I said, think about – here, I tell my kids, what was popular when my kids were 10 to 15 years old? Okay, that's what will be the hot collectible when they're 50. When they have expendable money and their kids are going out of college and they're at their peak earning, they're going to want to buy the shit that they thought was cool back then. And so there is why I buy that Pokemon card. You see, that is why I loaded up on the Pokemon cards back then, because I knew there was going to be a bigger pool of buyers coming later down the road. And so that's the whole play. I mean, that's the play with trading futures. That's the play with trading stocks. I mean, you're not trying to get there late. I mean, you're trying to get there early and then leave the party early. You don't want to get late and then sell late. I mean, you just get your ass kicked. So, no.
Well,
the key is
but
early and leave early. So that's my theory anyway. I mean, do
no,
what you
I
want.
I agree with that. I don't want to go on a rabbit trail, but learning, what's the right one to go into and am I early? Just, figuring all the details out. But, I'll hammer that out and then I'll be better prepared.
No, I'm just saying, I think Lance had one hell of a run. I think it's been a great run. A lot of people believe they can see this run. Yes. I would be hesitant right now to go out. If I had millions and millions and millions of and I was going to put money to work, I'd be careful right here.
Okay.
I'm just thinking you could get a better – I think there's going to be a better buying window.
You make a great point. You've convinced me, and my comment is retracted. But that makes sense. Everything you said is absolutely makes sense. Mine was based on just, too much feel and too much what I'm seeing currently. And that you're right. It is probably not how it's going to stay. So let us – that was good. So, I mean, the bottom line there, Kevin, is just, man, you're not sure that we're going to – Can ag just continue to get these things? Will they be there? And make sure you're positioned if these things aren't coming.
I'm just worried about ag in general as we consolidate. Consolidate and give out more subsidies and all of it's tied to these elevated land prices, I'm worried that on the break, every break it comes down to this. Who in the hell can hold their breath the longest as they stay underwater, right? That's all a break is. You're going underwater. You don't know how long you're going to be underwater. So it's whoever can hold their breath the longest has got the best chance to survive. So whoever has the least amount of debt is sitting on the most amount of cash. That's why I'm just saying, on a break, this next break in ag, you're going to decimate these smaller farmers and these small farm family operations. And you're going to see consolidation, in my opinion, accelerate. And that's what I worry about. I'm just worried that, eventually you're going to come down to what do we say, 2,000, 3,000 big-time operators, and you're going to shake a lot of other people just completely out because of the setup. The setup is the subsidies and the borrowing power. And, that's where I'm talking about, and I think that those could become somewhat of a problem, and that's all. That's all I'm saying. And I don't have the damn solution because I see what the government's doing. They're trying to avoid an ag crisis, and by giving they can't give the money to Farm Credit Services or John Deere or Bayer or the big ag conglomerates because everyone will lose their minds. So the money basically goes to the farmer and then from the farmer's hand straight to the big ag conglomerate. So it isn't like farmers just reaping tons of this money that's floating around. It's going to avoid a banking crisis, with the lenders that have lent out all this money based on the elevated farm ground as collateral. So it's just a little wicked web that has been woven. And I just worry if and when it comes apart. I don't know if it will come apart, Todd, because I said this. Both political parties like to use the farmer as their, they use the farmer to, they're doing something good for. So I don't think the Democrats are going to cut any farm subsidies. I don't think the Republicans are. It doesn't look like either. So like I was saying, the only way that it all unwinds is, you know, you cut off the farm subsidies. Now you may have just cut off what's been keeping all this alive. You know, that's the medicine that they're pumping in this bad boy. So I don't know if that ever gets cut off. I'm just not sure it does. So that's all I'm saying there.
Yeah, well, not last time, probably not. All right, moving on to some macro stuff, brother. This one was weak. You talked about it in the report. This one was weak. A lot going on. Too many headlines. Fed meeting. Big tech earnings. Middle East. Blah 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 blah. In the midterm uncertainty. How do you decide, Kevin, what actually deserves your attention and what's noise? Basically, as it comes when you start looking at your investments or, you know, trades for the short term.
Meaning.
Well, there's so much. There's so many headlines out there. I know you don't chase headlines, and you know we're talking to people that are, you know, trying to invest money. I mean, where's your focus? Let's narrow it down. Where's your focus this week with all these headlines?
So
the Feds, big tech earnings, or the Fed meeting?
You just want me to read you my positions out of my stock account? What do you want me to do?
We're gonna get there anyway. Sure, we're gonna get there anyway.
I'm not running any fancy plays at this point. I think there's going to be a pullback some point. We've had a little bit of a pullback in the stock market already, but I think you can see a little pullback in the market between now and the midterms, just because I think the media will go a little nuts. I think things will get a little tricky. I don't know. I mean, but I don't, like I said, I don't have anything.
Let me ask you this.
Your favorite, you know, what are you asking me? What do I own right now?
Here's what I really wanted. This wasn't an investing thing as well. It was hey man, tell us how the piece, give us to Kevin Van Trump, how the pieces are moving, the strategizing, where he sees the global, I mean, all the things. I mean, this is not about so much investing yet, but.
Well, no, my thing is just, I stay at a broad low, but if the Fed comes out and hikes, I'm going to liquidate more. I'm going to move more money into cash. I mean, I think the only way you really stumble here aggressively is the Fed makes a mistake. I think the Fed makes a mistake by hiking. And, you know, if they hike aggressively, if they hike twice or if they hike once for a half instead of a quarter, I think that could be a mistake. As I've said several times, I think the AI story is the story. That's what kept the stock market screaming higher and at new highs. And AI needs cheap money, and it needs a lot of available labor. And right now, you're not seeing that. The money, the back end of the yield curve staying elevated, and money's not really cheap. And most of the trade is talking that the Fed could hike. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think they're going to hike ahead of the midterm. Most everybody's looking for one. It's a September meeting. Some are even thinking they could come at this meeting, you know, the announcement here on Wednesday. So I'm not in that camp. And like I said, I just think still there could be a pullback somewhere in here, and I'm going to put a little more money to work. So, and to let everyone know, if you want an update, I just pulled up my own account.
Yeah, no, let's, you know, I mean,
and
sure.
This is just one of my longer term investing accounts. It isn't some crazy day trading account or something. I mean, it's just normal account.
Good.
My biggest position is the triple Qs. Next, I got IBV, BOO. Those are both just ETF, S&P 500 ETFs. I've got Ron Barra's up there. I've got Eli Lilly's my biggest single stock holding. XLF is also one of my bigger positions. That's the financials. That's just all the big banks. I also have a sizable position in the XLI. And I guess back to those individual stocks. Yeah, Lilly's my biggest position. And then Bunge, John Deere, Andersons, Ferrari, Live Nation, Google, NVIDIA, Meta, Amazon, TKO, Marvell. Yeah, that's it. I also have SpaceX, which I guess would be my smaller position. And Cal-Maine Foods. I started trimming down Cal-Maine Foods the last couple of days. Boy, what a hell of a run I had. And that's been a good one. They're the biggest egg producer. Now, they didn't pay their quarterly dividends this quarter because they had a sizable loss. But the stock has just done great off the break and rebounded back. That's one that Bob talked about, Todd, at FarmCon this last year. Wow. I've traded in and out of it.
I was about to ask you. I wanted to share with the audience, where in the world did you hear that? So you just answered that. So yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't think.
Okay. And then, you know, I have been buying some gold each time we dip back below that 4,000 level. You know, so I don't know. I'm not doing anything really, and there's really nothing else I'm doing much in. So,
yeah.
Like I said, all the stocks that I currently have and the positions I currently have, I would be happy to be a buyer on massive, bigger breaks because I want to stay in them for a long, long, long time. So, the big breaks, bring them. I've got a lot of money sitting on the sideline, and I want to add to these positions. I had a nice position in ADM. I still have some ADM and some other accounts that just one hell of a run off of the, they had that accounting debacle and they beat the hell out of stock, and then it just made one hell of a run back. And I like the ag. I like the ag stocks here just because of all the fireworks and the craziness that are happening with these wars and in the logistics. And I think your bigger ag, your ADMs, your Bungies, Cargill obviously is a privately held company, but the Andersons, I like, I think there's a lot of play. There could be some upside with the biofuel plays, with the crush, with what's happening with renewables on the renewable diesel side, and with everything being out of position somewhat. I think that gives them a bigger advantage. Like, they're going to have an advantage, like, move things around and get them into areas where, they can get a bigger premium, or take stuff out of areas where they're getting a discount and get that move to a country or an area where it's going to get better premium. So, I don't know. I just think there's some room there to the upside, and that's kind of how I'm playing it. So,
very good, and I appreciate all that. I know you don't all this debt talk stuff, but I want to bring it up because it was kind of big in the news that the U.S. federal debt surpassed 100% of gross domestic product for the first time since World War II, which renewed the debate over our fiscal outlook. Now, Jamie Dimon was rather vocal and said you can't run wartime level deficits during peacetime economic expansion without eventually facing music. And that phrase, facing music, I think something is just not talked about enough. But he says the bond market will eventually demand higher compensation for taking at risk, and then that just lights up a whole bunch of things. Paint us a picture on how bad this situation is, or is it one of those things where you just like, dude, nothing we can do, it's going to take you. I don't know. I don't feel like I grasp on your view of all this debt. Like, it's not a big deal sometimes.
Well, I mean, how many times are we going to listen to Jamie Dimon and Ray Dalio come out and say this? I mean, sure, great. I mean, they've been saying it for the last 10 years. No shit. I mean, we got it. We see the debt where it's at. I mean, I think the current administration believes that they can get the economy stimulated and turn around some of these trade deals, that they can get that debt reduced, in a big way. Depending on how this, if they can get the economy stimulated and boosted and turn around. Okay. I don't know that. The whole world is in massive debt. So, are we the best house in a shitty block? Or, that's what you got to ask yourself, right? Don't know.
It's too bad, but you're right. That's the deal. The dichotomy of the fact that we as individuals, are held our feet to the stone on credit and own debt, this and that, and yet you just see this. And, we all benefit it when the economy's great and money's flowing and interest rates are down. But, dude, it's got to be a face to music at some point, but who knows. But bring this all together because right now we're seeing the choke points all over the place. We're seeing, logistics, like you said, really becoming an issue. And the oil, energy's going to probably complicate the Fed's path forward. Just speaking of what you're seeing and your thoughts on, what's happening with the logistics and the energy cycle and how that may affect the Fed.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to.
Okay, good. Next question.
What do you want me to say? Crude's trading at $80 a barrel. You got massive bombing taking place in Iraq. You got choke points cut off everywhere. You got demand for crude oil in the shitter. Demand sucks for crude right now. That's the whole thing. It's like, you're saying much demand. Tell me, is that just a nuance, or is that a one-off, or is that Is that how we're going to move going forward here with all the alternative energy sources in place? I don't really know. I think people have lost their minds a little bit on the spread rate hike thing. I just can't get my head around it. I don't see why the Fed needs to raise rates at this moment. Like I said, crude's trading at $80 a barrel. Yes, you had the run up in energy, in prices at the pump, and they're probably going to stay elevated for a little while. Is my guess, but
it can be so frustrating. I feel like I got to bring it up, but we end up the same. I'm going to figure out better ways to. There's nothing to talk about, I guess. I mean,
you're just frustrating yourself, though. It's like, what are you going to do about the government debt problem? I mean, and
pay my part, I guess.
Well, if a check shows up in your mailbox, I guarantee your ass is going to go cash it.
So what are they sending me a check for?
And you're gonna get a tax refund back. You're not gonna send it back to them, are you?
Hey, I sarcastically said I'm just glad I owe taxes. It means you're making money, right?
No, I agree. That's where I'm saying I'm telling you, I don't have the answer for the debt problem. And I just think too many people have lost out on so much opportunity buying the doom and gloom magazines and reports of the doom and gloom stuff. It's sad, in my opinion. It's sad how much money people have missed out on or lost out on over the last 10, 15 years subscribing to the doom and gloom people. Every bear eventually will be right? I mean, eventually that's going to happen. You're going to have something, and you can be like, aha, I told you so. Well, I mean,
sure.
So what? I mean, millions were made. I mean, you had the opportunity to make, there was tons of money to be made. And, I just don't know. I just can't look at it that way.
Okay. I guess what I see sometimes, maybe I don't articulate it well, is, I mean, look at the wealth gap. The only reason, and correct me if I'm wrong or add your input, the reason wealth gaps exist there is because of how this whole fiscal monetary thing worked out, and the wealthy are able to, get the assets and get first access to money, and they make money off it, and it just widens and widens, which is going to lead to, at some point, some social unrest, which, we've seen in the past a little bit. It's a demographical change that's affected because of the way that the game is played. Do you not agree with that? A societal change, a cultural shift.
Well, I don't know if I totally agree with the I don't know. Because all I'm saying is this. Back in, in the 70s, or, let's go back there. You had this elite, half a percent of 1% of whatever. That was kind of your big money player. And then everyone else was lumped in the middle, and then you had your people that were below the poverty line. Okay, well, now, you've moved a shitload of people from the middle class to the upper, to the middle wealthy class. You have just more classification. You've moved a lot of those people have been moved up. You do have a smaller middle class, but you've just moved more up the tier, and you've had some move down the tier. And so, like I said, the absolute middle is a little bit less. So you have your haves and your have-nots is what I would call it now.
Right.
Or before, I think the majority were just all kind of middle class. You had a few rich people, and you had some that were really, really poor, but the majority, we were all in that same thing. We were all eating bologna and, doing our thing and living in a little suburbia place, right? I mean, we were kind of all clumped in there. Now I think it's more the haves versus the have-nots. That's probably how it continues to shake out.
Seems like it.
Yeah. But if you look at it from a global perspective, but if you look at it from a global perspective, what a run it's been. We've pulled so many people out
this
of poverty. You've raised it like crazy. So it's not really, yes, you're wealthy. You've gotten ultra wealthy, some of them, for sure. But, we have pulled a ton out of the poverty.
So it is a perspective on which data set. Yeah, I guess.
That's
you.
What I'm
saying. Yeah. So I just found it interesting because it does seem to be, you get these numbers, you look at how it affects society or culture, stuff like that, kind of like that, State of Fertility report that we ran yesterday. It's like, man, you look at things, you're like, gosh, dang it, things are going to be different. You know, it's affecting housing markets and stuff like that. But
demographically, we got a problem, right, with not having babies,
yeah.
And that's right. A big problem. And
I agree.
That's a tough
you were
one,
shocked right? by that. You said that you were astonished by some of the data in that report. That it was.
Well,
just,
it's sad, is what it is. It's sad, but
I agree. You know, it is sad because the priorities change, things change, and
yeah.
Let me ask you this:
I wanted to have kids. You know, just so many more people not wanting to have kids.
I know, and you don't think about the time, then all of a sudden say, "Hey, man, we ain't got nobody left in the game." You know, it's like it never occurred to me growing up until the last few years. We started seeing I never saw these kind of data until last working for you, and I was always in circles that, everybody had three kids still, and at least,
kids are hard, Todd. Kids are hard. People don't like hard.
No. Bingo, dude. All right. Let's take a high school freshman. Someone, I want to ask you this. We ran a tweet that said, if Lance Roberts had a tweet that showed all the mid-career salaries from, I don't know, about 70 different things. But right now, Kevin, I'm asking you to share, because there's probably a lot of parents out there might be listening. You got a high school freshman right now. How are you going to advise them, preparing them, for the beyond college days? What are you going to tell them to do for them when they get out of high school? I mean, what would you suggest they think about in preparation for their adulthood?
Do they have any athletic ability?
they're good to putt-putt. I remember telling – I was going to tell Jesse back in the day, hey, yeah, you need to be able to program a computer. Or you need to be this. It's like, dude, the uncertainty is kind of high right now with different things. I mean, I'm in the camp, go get your doggone. But you said people don't like hard. Go get your blue collar stuff. I mean, Mike Rowe's constantly making these reports about electricians and stuff making $240,000. And that ain't going to last forever, probably, once things get built out or this build out crashes, whatever. But, man, these trades seem like a hard thing to pass on now for a lot of folks. Yes, no,
yeah,
maybe,
I mean,
so.
I'm not a do things for money guy, so I'm not that. I think parents screw their kids up a lot when they give them all that kind of advice. So
that's true.
I like
that's a good point.
Well, I'm just saying, money's important.
You want your kid to eat though.
Well, I got it, but I think they will if they're doing things not for money. I've said my whole life, whenever I did anything for money, yeah, it ended up buzzsawing me. It was the dumbest thing I ever did. And I say that again in this camp. That's why I said I don't like it when parents try to, give their kids career advice in a big, bad way. Just the reason is because most parents are going to give them that advice from a financial or monetary standpoint, which
true.
I think's crazy. I just don't like that. I think you can make fortunes. Absolutely. My whole thing is this: be the best that you can possibly be at whatever you pick to be. And if you can do that, you're going to make just ridiculously, but the byproduct will be crazy. Because, I mean, hell, there's garbage people that end up making fortunes. I mean, end up running their own. I mean, my kid could go get on a garbage truck, work garbage career, and then end up owning a garbage company and make millions of dollars.
Right.
So I think mostly it's be flexible. I'm just telling you, most of it is this. We're having this question. I have some. Oh, there's some. I got a nephew that's getting ready to graduate college. He'll be a senior next year, and he was doing an internship with Jordan, and we got some others. But I just think you don't want to pigeonhole yourself down. You don't want to get rigid in your thinking. You want to be flexible. Whenever a window opens, jump through the damn thing. Take the opportunity. See where it takes you. Too many people are just worried and second guessing and. Oh, the benefits are great over here, and it's going to be a great job 40 years from now, and this is a real – I don't know. Sure, that might be for some folks, but
right.
I think you got to take the opportunities when they arise, when they present themselves. If I got kids in high school, I've never even talked – my kids, we never even really talked about what they were going to go do when they were in high school. I just didn't see a need in it. I wanted them to stay flexible. I just didn't want to be like, my whole life, you need to be an architect. You need to be an architect. I never talked to Kennedy one time about being an architect once in her life.
Right.
She pulled that habit out of her own hat. Never talked to Jordan about it. Jordan's dream was always he was going to be a professional baseball player. Kennedy was going to do her thing. And she had dance and guitar and those things, and I like that artsy side of it. I think it makes your mind be better and broader, and I like that whole path, and I like just being open and flexible. Don't say, oh, I have to go work for some big company to get a stable career and a job. I mean, I don't know. I think I'm more than a surfer. You know, I like just kind of floating and seeing what comes open, and if an opportunity pops up, you jump in there and you take it and you make the best of the situation and see where it takes you. And all of my friends, it seems like to me that the wealthiest of friends that I have, we're all that way, you know. They rolled with the punches a little bit, and they were flexible. And hell, a lot of them, you know, either got shit canned or left a job or left this or it didn't work out. And then all of a sudden they started their own thing, and boom. And the next thing, they made something great of it. And I love those stories. And I love seeing kids have that type of flexibility and you know, to do those types of things. And that's how I got to the success level I got to. You know, my wife was super cool, allowed me to try a few things. I mean, I've been below broke. I mean, I've been in the ground backwards, upside down broke. Like, I'm starting from negative. I mean, starting from zero is one thing, but hell, we're negative starting in there. A couple of different. So, and that's all I say. Keep taking some swings, keep taking some cuts. And, you know, I think there's going to be huge opportunities for kids moving forward. That's why I'm not a doom and gloomer about the AI, because I think for the right people, the AI is going to make those people millions and millions. I'm not wanting my kids or grandkids to go work in a factory and just get a secure, stable income job. I want them to go for it in life, you know? I mean, that's me. I want them to go for it. And how do you go for it is you get hit and take a bunch of punches, get knocked down, get shit knocked out of you, and you get back up and you get back in there again, and then you get knocked down, you get shit knocked, you get back in there again. You know, now, if you don't want to get knocked down and you don't want to get punched in the face and get knocked out a few times, well, yeah, then you got to go take those jobs and, you know, take the steady pay, take the benefits, and you just, you know, stay in that mediocrity ground. And that's that play. But I don't like that play. I'm just saying that's not – I just don't know how you get out of that once you're in that. That's, I guess,
you don't. You don't. But once again, I'm gonna say, the more, and it just hit me again. You know, dude, your background, where you grew up, what you had, what you didn't have. The kids that grew up in suburban Johnson County, what they have, what they didn't know about guys. Like, I mean, it forms who you are. So you just think you got to do that. Your parents drilled in, like you said. But then you know, dude, you had nothing to lose in a sense. Guys like you back in the day when you go out
that's
and
do stuff.
I'm just saying, it was a different mindset to got you than to all of a sudden you see the whole scope of possibility. Hey guys, I mean dude, you battled it with me in a sense, trying to infuse your philosophy. I get it, but it's still hard to adjust. And I was trained a people pleaser. I was in the golf pro, private country club. The guy walks in the door, I got to be a chameleon, take care of him. And dude, I came working for you. I had no clue, but you're like, hey man, go be a revenue center. Talking to me. I didn't get it. I mean, unlearning. It goes back to the theory we've talked about 100 times on different sides. Unlearning is the hardest thing people are going to do, and so
but
you
that's
are
the whole
are,
key. Learn, unlearn, relearn.
No,
learn,
it is the learn. Key. 100% the key. So
and you even said it in golf. I remember one time I was out there with you, and Al, you had a shitload of people around you. You were kicking ass at the time, but you were saying, you know, the best thing. You were deep into the golf thing at that point, and we were all both really good golfers. But you said, Kevin, if I could invent something to deprogram people, I'd just make a fortune. I said, what are you talking about? He's like, man, I get all these golfers that come to me that have been to all these different instructors, and they are just – they can't unlearn it, can they, Todd? They can't unlearn.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
Not all of it. There's no open – you're not coming with an open palate to learn. You spend – I don't want to call it a waste of time, but you spend a lot of time, hey, man, we got to quit thinking like that. And I don't know how to go about doing that quickly. I had to do it with – yeah, I mean, yeah, just because you're good gracious in our relationship, you know, I mean, hell, you should have fired me a long time ago for unproductive, but the point is, you know, I over time I learned, I see the different pictures and hear your message every day instead of a message from, you know, the other messages. So it's an interesting thing, but yeah, you have to, your flexibility comments, you're open-minded, you're staying opportunities, and then being ready to pounce. But, dude, the mindset of, hey, I got to go get a career and work 40 years at a company. Sure, that's not there anymore, but still that safety thing and other stuff is. But no, great insights, and it's all the same thing. Easy said, hard to execute. Plans are simple. Execution, not so much if you're not strong minded. I don't know what the right word is. Next week, we got Dan Maycock. We're going to get some real down-to-earth practical, hey, make your money, make some more money on the farm by doing some of these things that are happening anyway. You know, what else you got for anything, Kevin, on a parting comment?
No, I think, you know, I think all the conversation was great. Yeah, I'm excited to get things rolling a little bit more on the FarmCon front as we move here deeper in the summer. And like I said, I think the markets are giving us lots of opportunities here. I'm pleased as can be that, you know, we're trading corn here at 480 versus 420 where we were, you know, end of June. So I 30 days and here we are. It's a lot better position than we were in. So I'm excited to see how this shakes out. And like I said, I got a few bullish positions on, and we'll see what happens here, Todd.
All right, brother. Listen, as always, appreciate your time, and we'll catch up next week.
All right, my man. See you. Bye.
Yeah, bye.